Hi, this is the March 2024 edition of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Radio Volunteer, Kathy Danaher. The headline on the cover of the March issue is Civil War Hero. Susie King Taylor escaped slavery, served as an Army nurse, and helped Black Americans forge a better future, all before she turned 16. On the cover is a picture of Susie, standing tall inside a simple hospital tent. We can see the environment that she worked in as a Civil War nurse, surrounded by rows and rows of tents that the soldiers slept in. Let's turn the page, and we begin first with geography. Ready for Ramadan. Every year, millions of Muslims gather in Mecca during this sacred holiday. On pages 2 and 3 is a photo of the worshippers in the courtyard of Islam's most important mosque. In the center of the courtyard, draped in black silk and embroidered with gold and silver threads, is the sacred Kaaba, which worshippers gather around to pray. Muslims from all over the world travel to Mecca, Saudi Arabia, year-round. But the number of visitors to the city will boom this month when Ramadan begins at sundown on March 10th. What is Ramadan? For the world's 2 billion Muslims, it is the most important time of the year. They focus on cleansing the mind and body, seeking forgiveness, and showing compassion toward others, especially the poor. People observing Ramadan fast for 30 days, consuming no food or drink between dawn and dusk. Some Muslims also make a pilgrimage to Mecca at this sacred time. As the birthplace of Muhammad, the founder of Islam, Mecca is considered the religion's holiest city. In 2023, more than 9 million people arrive there in the first 10 days of Ramadan alone. Islamic pilgrimage traditions vary, but all include prayers at a shrine called the Kaaba. During Ramadan, tens of thousands of pilgrims in Mecca surround the Kaaba to pray. They also circle the shrine 7 times, the entire mass of pilgrims moving together in harmony. Next, on page 4, under U.S. and World News, Mickey goes public. Disney no longer controls its oldest mouse. What happens now? In the upper right, we see a drawing of the first version of Mickey Mouse and the way he looked in 1928 when he appeared with Minnie Mouse in a cartoon called Steamboat Willie. You may have noticed Mickey and Minnie Mouse popping up more than you're used to, and not just in the usual places. Why? For 95 years, these famous characters have been under copyright. That means only creator Walt Disney from 1901-1996 and his company could use them. But in January, the copyright for the cartoon they first appeared in expired. As a result, Mickey and Minnie are now both in the public domain, meaning people can freely use their images on t-shirts, in video games, or even in new cartoons or movies. Still, it's complicated. People are allowed to use only the version of the characters from Steamboat Willie in 1928. The first cartoon with sound, it helped launch the Disney empire. Later versions of Mickey and Minnie, including how they appear today, are still protected by copyright law. What is the purpose of copyrights? The limits protect artists and creations, but they expire so that everyone can eventually benefit from the work, say experts such as Jennifer Jenkins of Duke Law School in North Carolina. After all, Many movies, novels, and songs that are popular today are based on older versions in the public domain. It's important to have meaningful access to older works for inspiring future creativity, Jenkins told the New York Times. On page 5 in Sports News, Turning Pro at 13. His name is Davion Kimbrough, an inspiring teen from Woodland, California. When is a kid mature enough to go pro? How about 13 years old? That's the age Davion Kimbrough was this past summer when he signed with Major League Soccer's Sacramento Republic FC. Then, in October, he became the youngest professional athlete ever to appear in a game. Davion has been playing soccer since he was 4 years old, but he really began attracting attention over the past 2 years as he scored a total of 61 goals for various youth teams. Still, some experts worry about the pressure on teens who turn pro. With that in mind, Sacramento public officials insist that Davion will be able to progress at his own pace. He will stay close to his family and continue his education while training, they say. Davion is taking it as it comes. I was a little nervous, he told Good Morning America about his debut. But I feel like once I stepped on the field, it was more exciting than anything. I tried to silence the noise and just play soccer. And on the upper right of the page, we see a smiling Kimbrough holding up his soccer t-shirt with the number 14 and his name Kimbrough across the top. On page 6, the fight against teen vaping. Thousands of e-cigarette products in bright colors and tempting flavors are illegally flooding the U.S. market. Learn what is being done to remove them and why you should steer clear. The picture on page 6 is a photo of 3 e-cigarette vapes designed to look like brightly colored AirPod cases surrounded by swirling gray clouds of nicotine smoke. Alexa Addison remembers what vapes, also known as e-cigarettes, looked like when she was in high school. Many of them were slim black rectangles with sharp corners, resembling flash drives. By the time Addison, now 19, started college in North Carolina in 2022, however, vapes had had a makeover. Many of her classmates were using Elf bars. These brightly colored e-cigarettes look like AirPod cases. But the playful packaging masks what is hidden inside. Nicotine, a dangerous and highly addictive substance that can damage the brain and lungs. Addison bought sweet and fruity flavors like strawberry kiwi. She took selfies when the vapes matched her outfits. Before long, she was going through an Elf bar a week. During a period of intense use, her gums turned gray, she says. Still, the devices, which young people often say look like candy, lip gloss, or fun soap, kept her vaping. They looked really pretty, honestly, Addison says. I just never had an interest in vaping until the pretty ones started being sold. Addison isn't the only one being drawn in. While e-cigarette use among teens has declined overall since 2019, use of the newer flavor devices is on the rise. About 1 in 10 high school students and 1 in 20 middle school students used an e-cigarette in the previous month, according to the 2023 National Youth Tobacco Survey. Doctors say that's troubling. Research shows that teens, whose brains are still developing, become addicted to nicotine more easily than adults do. And one Elf bar has as much nicotine as 590 traditional cigarettes, according to a study by Stanford University in California. it's illegal for people under 21 to buy cigarette products in the first place. And to top it off, the vast majority of the estimated 11,500 vaping products on the market are not authorized by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. The FDA is a federal agency whose job it is to ensure that products for sale, such as food and cosmetics, are safe to use. Several e-cigarette brands, including Elf Bars, have been banned from being imported to the United States at all. So, why are these tempting products still on store shelves and getting into the hands of young people? Most U.S. states began restricting how cigarette companies market their products to kids and teens in 1998. Decades of research had shown that the tobacco and cigarettes carry significant health risks. Tobacco is made up of thousands of toxic chemicals, some of which can cause cancer. E-cigarettes, which were invented about 20 years ago, do not contain tobacco. Some companies have marketed them as a safe alternative to cigarettes as a result. But, like cigarettes, they do contain nicotine. And though the research is ongoing, what experts do know so far is alarming. Studies have found that vaping may be linked to lung disease. On the upper right of the page, the information box tells us how vaping could affect your health. The toxic chemicals can cause serious side effects: coughing, nausea, headaches, difficulty concentrating, asthma, heart disease, and lung disease. Vaping may also worsen mental health issues such as anxiety or depression in people who already have those conditions. That hasn't stopped cigarette companies from trying to appeal to kids and teens, though. The companies want lifelong customers, so they try to attract new users when they are young, experts say. Today's trendy and colorful e-cigarettes are just another attempt to win over teens, according to everyone from lawmakers to anti-smoking groups. There is no question that the latest vapes are designed to catch the eyes of young people who are drawn toward bright colors and rounded shapes, says Susan Lin. She is a professor at Harvard Medical School in Massachusetts. Tobacco companies use cartoons or brightly colored packaging in order to hook kids, to make kids think that this is fun and harmless, she says. The appealing flavors are another pull for teens, with names like Banana Cake and Watermelon Bubblegum. Elf Bar was the leading e-cigarette brand last summer among middle and high school students who vape, according to the 2023 National Youth Tobacco Survey. If it looks glamorous and it looks appealing, that's going to be the first driver that will bring a horse to water, says Brian King, head of the FDA's Tobacco Center. The flavors then get them to drink, and the nicotine keeps them coming back for more. The company that manufactures Elf Bar, Miracle Shenzhen Technology, says it markets to adults. Representatives for the company point out that their products carry the required warning label that nicotine is addictive. The FDA banned Elf Bar and a few other brands this past summer because of their appeal to teens and kids. Still, finding the products isn't hard. Shelves in convenience stores, gas stations, and other businesses across the nation are lined with thousands of vapes in bright colors and fun flavors. What's going on? Many e-cigarettes that wind up in the U.S. are imported illegally from China. There is high demand. Vapes generated $8.3 billion of revenue in the U.S. last year alone. So, companies find creative ways to get their products into the country. When the FDA bans imports of something, it directs U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials to seize incoming shipments. But tens of thousands of shipping containers full of various products arrive daily at U.S. ports. It is impossible for inspectors to check them all. What's more, some vague shipments are labeled as shoes, toys, or other items. Another tactic is to quickly rename banned products. Elf Bar now goes by at least two other names. One of those products is still allowed entry into the U.S. Meanwhile, new vaping products continue to pour into the country. Because the FDA's authority to target foreign companies is limited, it has focused on businesses in the U.S. Last year, the agency sent thousands of warning letters to gas stations and convenience stores. It ordered them to stop selling unauthorized vapes. There are only about two dozen FDA-authorized brands of e-cigarettes on the market today, and none of them are flavored. The FDA has also issued dozens of fines totaling about $20,000 each to stores that did not comply with the order. Parents, anti-smoking groups, and lawmakers are calling for even stronger action to address underage vaping. Some states are taking matters into their own hands. California and Massachusetts have barred the sale of all flavored tobacco products, and other states are considering similar bans. Young people are stepping up, too. Many are spreading the word about kicking the habit, and a number of groups are helping them do it. One national organization, Truth Initiative, offers a free text messaging program to coach teens through the process of quitting. That's how Carolee Alcantara of Silver Spring, Maryland, stopped using e-cigarettes. Now 22, the university student started vaping during her sophomore year of high school. "I was really stressed about college applications and my grades," she says. "So, every time I would get anxious, I would vape." Before long, Alcantara noticed she was having trouble sleeping and focusing. She learned about Truth Initiative through social media and decided to sign up. Over time, the daily texts of encouragement helped her quit. They even gave her tips on how to manage her anxiety in healthier ways. Now Alcantara works as a student ambassador for the organization. She visits school campuses to talk to young people who want to help stop using e-cigarettes. Her advice for kids and teens who want to quit vaping: reach out to someone you trust and ask for help, she says, and know you're not alone. On page 10, True Teens of History, A Voice for Freedom. Susie King Taylor offered healing and hope to the Union's first black soldiers during the Civil War. Then she preserved her story and theirs in a powerful memoir. The picture on page 10 and 11 is of a Civil War camp, and we see Susie tending to a black Union soldier who was wounded and in need of care. Susie King Taylor stared anxiously at the path leading into camp. All night, the crackle of distant rifle fire had kept the 15-year-old awake in her tent. Now it was morning, and she still smelled gunpowder on the breeze. Where were they? It was July 1864 on Morris Island in South Carolina. Days earlier, Susie had watched hundreds of Union Army troops march out of camp. A group of southern states known as the Confederacy had broken away from the United States in 1861, opposed to ideas of ending slavery. The Union Army was fighting to keep the nation together. Susie knew some of the troops from her camp would never return. Most of them had escaped slavery, like Susie herself. they were among the first black men to fight in the Civil War from 1861 to 1865. A victory for the Union Army would help secure freedom for millions of black Americans. Susie felt proud to be part of the effort. Her official job was washing uniforms, but Susie did much more. She taught the soldiers to read and write, and she cared for the wounded as one of the first black Army nurses. Suddenly, Susie heard cries of pain. A few soldiers staggered into view, their uniforms stained with mud and blood. She knew even more wounded men would follow. Susie took a deep breath. Then she ran to get bandages. The fight for freedom was close to Susie's heart. Born in August 1848, she spent her early years enslaved in coastal Georgia on a plantation called Grest Farm. Her mother labored in the house. Susie might have been forced to work there too. However, her grandmother Dolly stepped in. Dolly had once been enslaved on Grest Farm. For an unknown reason, the Grest family had allowed her to move to the nearby city of Savannah. Dolly lived independently, but the family remained her legal guardians. When Susie turned 7, the Grests let her move in with Dolly. At the time, it was illegal for enslaved children to attend school. But Dolly sent Susie to a secret school in the home of a free black woman. Susie made sure to enter only when no one was looking. She covered her books and newspaper to hide them from the police. If caught, both Susie and her teacher would face steep fines. They might also be whipped in public. The risks paid off. Susie mastered reading and writing at a time when only 5% of black people in Georgia were literate. Yet, she lived in fear. Would she be arrested for continuing to take lessons or ordered back to the plantation? From her grandmother's window, she sometimes saw other enslaved children being marched down the street to the auction block to be sold to the highest bidder. The terrible sight haunted her. In the spring of 1862, when Susie was 13 years old, her life turned upside down. Police arrested Dolly. They accused her of plotting to become free. Immediately, Susie was sent back to Grest Farm. The Civil War had started the year before, and Georgia, a Confederate state, was a key battleground. War supplies could be shipped in along its Atlantic coast. The Union wanted to block those supplies. Just days after Susie was forced back to Grest Farm, Union troops began a siege on nearby Fort Pulaski. Susie could hear the roar of cannons from the plantation. Like other enslaved people in the South, the teen faced a difficult decision. She could stay put and hope to be freed after the war, or she could flee to territory controlled by the Union for a chance at freedom now. If she got caught, she would be likely to be brutally whipped, or worse. Susie decided to run. On April 13th, she fled Grest Farm with her uncle and several cousins. Following the smell of the Atlantic Ocean's salty sea air, the group scrambled 25 miles east to the Georgia coast. There, they were taken in by Union forces, nicknamed Yankees by Southerners. Susie later recalled the joy she felt. "I wanted to see these wonderful Yankees so much, as I heard my parents say, the Yankee was going to set all the slaves free," she wrote. She would soon learn that wasn't quite the case. A Union boat took Susie and the others to nearby St. Simon's Island. About 600 other formerly enslaved men, women, and children had also taken refuge there. Escaping slavery hadn't made them completely free, however. The Union Army treated them as contraband or property that had been taken from the Confederacy, not as people. Even worse, Susie and the others weren't safe. Confederates sometimes snuck into the island to kidnap black people and return them to their slavers. There was a bright spot, though. After learning that Susie was educated, a Union officer gave her books to set up a school. She held class for 40 children every day and their parents at night. Even as a teen, she understood that knowing how to read and write could help black Americans succeed after the war, says historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Dunbar wrote the biography Susie King Taylor, Nurse, Teacher, and Freedom Fighter. Susie believed in the power of literacy and knew that without it, freedom was limited, says Dunbar. On January 1st, 1863, U.S. President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. The order formally freed the 3.5 million enslaved people in states that had withdrawn from the Union. It was official. Susie and the other escapees on St. Simon's Island were no longer contraband. They held a barbecue to celebrate. It was a glorious day for us all, she wrote. Black men could now officially enlist in the Union Army. On the upper right of page 13, the information box tells us about black troops on the battlefield. After the Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863, the U.S. military began actively recruiting black troops. You will set an example of generous self-sacrifice which will conquer prejudice and open all hearts, one recruitment poster promised. About 179,000 black men enlisted as soldiers in the Union Army. Another 19,000 joined the Navy. Though they were fighting for their country, black troops were not treated equally compared to white troops. They typically served in segregated units, and they were paid $10 a month, with $3 taken out of their paychecks for uniforms. White soldiers received $13 per month, with no such fee. In June 1864, Congress granted black troops equal pay, along with the back wages that they were owed. Black troops served honorably despite the challenges. During the Civil War, 26 black Americans earned the Medal of Honor for courage in battle. But even before the proclamation, the men of St. Simon's had organized into the 33rd United States Colored Infantry Regiment. It was one of the war's first black units. Susie, now 15, traveled with the 33rd through Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. She washed laundry. She cleaned weapons. She packed ammunition into boxes. She filled canteens and portioned out meals of salted beef. Plus, she taught reading and writing to off-duty troops. Like many black women working for the Union, Susie was paid nothing. And she later wrote, I gave my service willingly for 4 years and 3 months without receiving $1. As the war dragged on, the number of sick and wounded soldiers grew. There simply weren't enough medical personnel to care for everyone. So volunteers like Susie took on yet another role, as nurses. The teen bandaged wounds, held damp cloths to fevered foreheads, and cobbled together ingredients for soup. Anything that needed to be done was often done by a nurse, says Terry Reamer of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine. Susie now felt much older than her 15 years. She had seen sickening injuries and watched people die. One day, she came upon several skulls in the road. She calmly moved them out of her path. "I had become accustomed to worse things," she later wrote. After 4 long years and about 620,000 deaths, the Civil War ended in the spring of 1865. The Union had won, yet some Confederates refused to stop fighting. As a result, Susie's unit battled on for nearly a year after the Confederacy surrendered. Formerly enslaved people began new free lives. Susie returned to Savannah and started her own school, charging $1 a month per student to cover the costs. But a free school opened a year later, putting her school out of business. In 1866, Susie's husband, Edward King, whom she had married during the war, died. Susie raised their son alone. Unable to find a steady teaching job, she worked as a cook and a house cleaner. When Susie remarried in 1879, she gained some financial security. She devoted herself to advocating for Civil War veterans. Susie worried that people had forgotten about the war and those who had served. Urged on by the soldiers she had once worked with, Susie penned her wartime memories. Her book, Reminiscence of My Life in Camp, was published in 1902. Historians believe it is the only Civil War memoir about Army life written by a black woman. And on page 12 on the lower left, there is a photo of Susie taken in 1860. It is believed to be the only published, confirmed photo of Susie King Taylor, and it was published in her book. In her book, Susie questioned how much life had really improved for black Americans after the Civil War. Yet, she remained optimistic. "We hope for better conditions in the future and feel sure they will come in time, surely if slowly," she wrote. Susie King Taylor died at the age of 64 in 1912, but she is still inspiring change. Early this year, she became the first woman and person of color to have a public square named in their honor in Savannah, Taylor Square. Dunbar, the historian, says Susie's extraordinary life serves as an example of what young people can accomplish. "I'm hoping that her story provides a legacy of activism," Dunbar says, "and for young people to see that their words and actions matter and can change society." Society. On the bottom of page 14, you can see next, on page 15, King Ezana's Empire. You might never have heard of Aksum, but the East African kingdom was one of the great powers of the ancient world. Are you ready to explore it? And on this page, we see a large picture of King Ezana's face with a gold crown on his head, gazing down over his kingdom below. It's the 4th century AD, and you are a traveler and adventurer, standing on the deck of a ship. After a long, wearying journey across the Indian Ocean, you're thrilled by the sight ahead, the bustling port of Adulis on North Africa's eastern coast. Adulis is one of the major trading centers of the famed Kingdom of Aksum. What will you find when you walk its streets? Is there any truth to the stories you've heard about Aksum's great power and wealth and its gloried leader, King Ezana? For years, you've heard talk of the kingdom. Aksum arose in about the 1st century AD as a town surrounded by fertile farmland. In the 3 centuries since, it has expanded into a prosperous empire. Now, in the 4th century, it is a booming center for international trade, protected by King Ezana's mighty army and navy. The kingdom lies roughly in the middle of major land and sea trade routes that connect Egypt and Europe to the north with India and other parts of Asia to the east. The result is a mishmash of peoples, cultures, and goods from near and far. When your ship docks, you likely find yourself amid a beehive of activity. All around you, dock workers haul cargo on and off ships lining the harbor. Many of the workers are shouting and calling to each other in Greek, the common language for intercontinental trade. Others speak regional languages, including Ge'ez, the traditional language of Aksum's people. Close to the harbor, merchants buy and sell local and exotic goods. These include iron ore and precious metals, ivory, jewelry and gems, textiles, salt and spices, dried fruits, livestock, and animal hides. Aksumite coins, some stamped with the face of King Ezana, change hands. Some of this currency will travel as far as India. When the merchant's trading is done, workers load some purchases onto pack animals that will travel overland in caravans. Many of the goods they carry will eventually be sold in Egypt or sent across the Mediterranean Sea to markets in Europe. Other workers pile goods onto ships at Adulis, destined for other African and Asian seaports. Ready to do more exploring, you follow a caravan of traders inland to the capital, a city also called Aksum. King Ezana has ordered a great cathedral to be built there, and you want to see it for yourself. Sometime after taking the throne, Ezana became the first African king to adopt Christianity. He has made it the kingdom's official religion, and because of his influence, Christianity is starting to spread to other parts of Africa. The King's Church of St. Mary in Zion is impressive, but what really captures your attention are the hundreds of stone slabs and pillars in and around the city. These stelae range from about 3 feet to nearly 100 feet tall. Inscribed mostly with symbolic images, the monuments honor Aksum's most important residents. Some stelae are hundreds of years old, while others are freshly carved. The newest honor King Ezana. One slab is different from the others, and it gives us information about King Ezana himself. Most of what we know about Ezana is thanks to Ezana. Not satisfied with only decorative stelae to honor him, he had workers etch stories of his achievements onto a large stone slab. Known today as the Ezana Stone, it is written in 3 languages, Greek, Ge'ez, and Sabaean, an early Arabic language. But the passages don't say the same thing. The Greek version, probably the only one that travelers from Egypt and Europe could read, boasts of the king's mercy and kindness toward rebels defeated by his army. But the Ge'ez and Sabaean versions, likely aimed at people closer to home, paint a fiercer, bloodier picture. Those accounts focus on Ezana's power and military strength, how his forces captured and killed enemies and seized livestock and lands. Which represents the real Ezana? With only his own declarations to go by, we'll probably never know. Most stelae are carved with ornate images representing windows and doors, but this one is inscribed with the writing of the 3 languages, which a passerby will help you translate. It describes some of King Ezana's great accomplishments as a ruler and a military leader. The king, it seems, is trying to ensure that his name and achievements live on by etching them in stone. As you ride away from the kingdom, you think back on all you have seen. If anyone asks, is there any truth about the stories about the great power and wealth of Aksum and its gloried leader, Izana? Your answer will probably be yes. Turning to page 18, the article reads, Should Your Face Be Your Ticket? Facial recognition software is making getting into concerts and sporting events easier than ever. But could it lead to more problems than it's worth? Picture this. You're finally about to see your favorite band in concert, but you're running late, and the lines at the stadium are super long. Fortunately, there is a special lane just for ticket holders who pre-registered a selfie. A monitor scans your face and checks it against the photo on file. Within seconds, you're in. For many people, that ease is the whole point of facial recognition. The process uses sophisticated software to measure and remember a person's face. Today, a growing number of public spaces are using facial recognition technology, including arenas, airports, Major League Baseball stadiums, and theme parks. Yet, some people are concerned about facial recognition's increasing role. In many cases, companies store a lot of personal data along with the picture of each face. That could include information about your family, your Facebook profile, even your bank account. The data could be given or sold to other companies or stolen by criminals. Are the risks that go along with facial recognition worth the convenience? Read arguments on both sides, then decide for yourself. The ID of the future. Facial recognition is making our daily lives easier, supporters believe. You don't need to remember a physical ticket or have a smartphone, says Derek Riley, a technology expert at the Milwaukee School of Engineering in Wisconsin. And there is very little risk of someone else using your ticket because no one else has your exact face. People who are developing facial recognition describe it as the ID of the future. Mary Haskett is the co-founder of Blink Identity, a company that supplies the service to concert venues. She likens each scan to a barcode of your face. Consider the countless places you might have to show identification to prove who you are, such as a bank or even your school cafeteria, she says. Then, imagine being able to just look at a monitor instead. Facial recognition simplifies a task that people do dozens of times every day. Besides, says Haskett, facial recognition is becoming a daily reality. Soon, you'll be unlocking your phone with your face, if you aren't already. New technology is almost always scary, she says, but it can improve lives. It is much more important to shape this process for the better, Haskett says, rather than trying to wish it didn't exist. But there is potential for misuse. Many Americans fear facial recognition is a serious threat to our privacy and freedoms. One critic is Caitlin Seeley George, a director of Fight for the Future, which promotes people's digital rights. She says many businesses are collecting a database of sensitive information about you along with your face. Companies could sell this information to other companies, she says. Why is that a problem? For one thing, businesses could use this data to target you with ads seeking to manipulate you into buying their products. Your information could also be hacked by thieves, she adds. According to the Federal Trade Commission, the practice of using stolen data to open new bank accounts under a victim's name grew by 32% in 2022. Even that easy ticket of your face could be used against you. For instance, security personnel at Madison Square Garden and Radio City Music Hall in New York City have denied certain people entry. Why? Facial recognition identified them as employees of law firms that were suing the venue's owners. Also, critics say the technology often misidentifies people, which could lead to enormous headaches. Your phone might refuse to unlock when it's time to make an important call. You could even miss a concert or flight because the software gets your identity wrong. These all might seem like minor things, but they have real, measurable impacts on people's lives, George says. On the top of page 19, in the information box called Finding Your Faceprint, here's how facial recognition systems identify you. Number one, detection. The system determines whether it is seeing a face. And this is what is happening when a box appears around a head on your phone's camera. Number two, analysis. Software analyzes your features, including the precise shape and size of your eyes, lips, and jaw, as well as the distance between them to create a face print. Number three, recognition. The system compares your face print with ones in its database to find a match, usually very quickly. On page 20, the last article in this edition of Junior Scholastic is called Chasing the Northern Lights. This is the best time of year to see nature's dazzling display of lights, but you have to head north first. And on page 20 and 21 is a picture of the Northern Lights in Churchill, Canada. The lights streak across the night sky in shades of green and yellow when particles from the sun collide with the atmosphere, in temperatures that can plunge to 40 degrees below zero. It's not easy to get to Churchill, Canada. No roads connect the tiny town in the north of the country to the rest of the world. The only way to get there is by taking a small plane or train across the frozen tundra. But that doesn't stop thousands of visitors from traveling to the remote location each winter in search of one of nature's most breathtaking wonders, the Northern Lights. These dazzling displays streak across the night sky with swirling shades of green, blue, pink, purple, red, and orange. It's like a river of colors dancing in the sky, says Dave Daly, a sled dog racer in Churchill and member of the Métis, an indigenous group in Canada. It's always amazing and always different. The Northern Lights are also known as the Aurora Borealis. The lights, called auroras, are created when electrically charged particles from the sun collide with gases high in Earth's atmosphere. The color of the lights varies depending on the type of gas. The shapes can also differ. Some auroras, for example, stretch out like bands, while others make arcs or ripples like waves. But seeing auroras in person isn't as simple as just looking up in the sky. There is one main area on Earth from which the Northern Lights are visible. Known as the Auroral Oval Zone, it includes the Arctic and surrounding regions. Churchill, a town of about 900 residents, lies just inside the Auroral Oval Zone. Part of the reason the zone offers such good views is that many places within it experience extended stretches of darkness in the winter. Some get no sunlight for months. In the Arctic, the Northern Lights are a regular part of life for the nearly 4 million people who reside there. They include hunters, herders, and indigenous groups who have lived off the land for generations and have adapted to the frigid temperatures. Many cultures from the area hold a special belief about the lights. A legend of Finland says the Aurora Borealis is created by a fire fox racing across the sky. As the mythical fox leaps above the snowy land, its tail spreads sparks. In Churchill, where indigenous groups such as the Dene, Cree, Inuit, and Métis live, many believe the lights are the souls of their ancestors watching over them. The auroras are important to more than just local cultures. They also help support local economies through tourism. For many travelers, observing the phenomena is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Over the past decade, the number of people flocking to Arctic destinations to see the Northern Lights has surged, and so have the number of hotels, restaurants, and specialty tours. In northern Norway alone, visitors are expected to jump by almost 10% this winter to about 350,000 people, according to a tourism industry group. Daly predicts Churchill will have its busiest year as well. He runs a tour company for adventure seekers hoping to experience the awe-inspiring sight. The lights can be seen on as many as 300 days a year in Churchill, but the best months to view them are from January through March, Daly says. That's when the skies are the darkest for the longest stretches. There are also fewer clouds on cold, crisp nights. During this time, most birds have migrated south. Polar bears, which can frequently be spotted around town, are off roaming the Arctic sea ice. Even the beluga whales have left for warmer waters. When we get quiet and cold and clear, Daly says, that's our Northern Lights season. That's it for this installment of Junior Scholastic. I'm Kathy Danaher. Chris Volunteer. So long, until next month.